Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 279, my conversation with improviser Jess Napthine Hodgkinson. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You get a free audiobook download as well as access to hundreds of books and podcasts, including Yes But Why. I've been using Audible to do some research for a story that I'm writing. I want to get into some books that, have a similar vibe, so I make sure that I'm writing something interesting and new and yet, fits into the genre. So, Audible can be helpful. It can be helpful for you if you want to relax. It can be helpful for you if you want to do some research on a topic. I mean, there's nonfiction books available, so there's lots that you can get into. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to sign up and get your account today. It's worth it. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is the company that my husband Chris and I run to help podcasters. We are constantly doing podcasting stuff, from creating our own podcasts to talking to friends about how to better our podcast. Every single person that I interview that vaguely could have an opinion on how I could better run my podcast, they help me out. I'm open to all the resources and I talk to everybody and I just want to share my community of people with you. So if there is anything that Chris and I can do to help you with your podcast, how to start it, how to keep it going, how to figure out what's going on, even though nobody's listening by episode 100, I feel you. We've got your back. And mention code YBY20 to get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. We can help. PodcastCadet.com. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my resource for vegan-friendly whole plant extract CBD oil. Check out TrueHempScience.com to see all the CBD products available to you now. There are all sorts of different things, tinctures and this great lotion that just really feels good. It's not weird or medicine-y. It's just sort of a little calming situation, not just moisturizing and great, but somehow the insides of my hands feel better when I put it on there. So, it's got some magic in it and it will totally help you out. So check it out and buy some for yourself. Everybody's talking about CBD. It's actually quite helpful. TrueHempScience.com. Use code YesButY7 and you get 7% off your order of $50 or more. Plus, you'll get a free packet of CBD edibles with your order. TrueHempScience.com. This week on Yes But Why, I talked to Jess Napthine Hodgkinson, co-founder of Glossop Improv. Listen in as we chat about Caravaggio's artwork, David Ashe's improv classes, and the newly invented socially distanced improv exercises that Jess has done recently with David Escobedo. It's called Moving the Fridge. Look forward to this and all the artistic rabbit holes in this episode. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 279, Jess Napthine Hodgkinson and how performing and appreciating art has shaped her perspective of the world. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I was much more interested in reading books than I was in any kind of socializing with anybody.
Sure.
So I didn't actually start doing anything theatre drama related until I was 20 when I started doing improv.
Yeah.
Up until then, it was even to the point where in school for GCSEs, back when I was doing GCSEs, which is a long time ago now, we were supposed to take one arts subject, so either music, art, or drama. And I had to basically beg to take another humanities subject so I didn't have to do anything artistic at all.
Was it like drawing and being on stage just seemed super too crazy for you? Because I would argue that reading books is creative. The idea of consuming stories is as creative as outwardly expressing those stories.
Yeah. Looking back now, I think back to myself and I was like, oh yeah, I was really creative. I just didn't want to share it with anybody. I wanted it to just stay in my head and live in my little fantasy world of all of these books that I'd been just voraciously consuming. And I still have a bit of a hang up about drawing and art and anything art related. Because when I was in primary school, I was always really, really bad at drawing, and I still am. I'm very kind of uncoordinated and not very dexterous. So I was always so bad at it that towards the end of primary school, the head teacher brought my parents in because my drawing that I'd done was so awful that she thought it was an act of willful defiance. Because we'd been asked to copy, I think it was like the Hay Wayne or something, some you know, classic painting. And we'd been asked to, you know, try and copy it and, you know, put your own interpretation on it. And mine was such a mess that she was just like, well, obviously Jessica just isn't trying and she's just doing this as an act of disobedience and I need to speak to her parents. And my parents were like, no, that's normal. That's just how she is. So I've always had a bit of a hang up about drawing. It's still a bit of a fear because I do a lot of sort of training and development at work. And so whenever my colleagues are like, oh, let's do a mind map of things and let's draw things, I'm just a bit like, no, I'll just make a list. That's fine.
A list is drawing. It's just a solid book. You're interested in like a rectangle sort of scenario. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're drawing. I think about that all the time because I don't feel very like visually artistic, you know, like I can't really draw very well. I've gotten better at craft stuff only just because like when you've got a little kid, there's like a lot of it. I mean, like I felt really terrible at the beginning. Like I had a rough time getting into crafts and I was like, start liking this, be into this. He needs you to do this. Yeah, and I found, like, my niche in, like, childhood art. You know, I'm like, okay, I can do this. This is pretty good looking. But I don't know how to put my pen to paper and make it look like something. No. Like, no, absolutely not.
Yeah, I'm just in awe of anybody that can as well. Like Ari, like the drawings that he does, the little sketches of improvisers and things like that. And he can do all sorts of stuff in all different mediums and I just find it like endlessly fascinating, but also I know that it would take me so long even to be able to do just such a basic thing that I just think my time is probably best spent elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, and also like here, okay, I agree with you, but it's not like we're like, I'm never going to do that. It's more like I have skills and I will do the things that I have skills of. I'm great at it. Happy to help you with whatever those things are. But there are some things that I am not so skilled at. And Absolutely. So I will be happy to offer the job to somebody else. Oh, what's that? Yeah. I can pay you to do a portrait of my husband and myself? Here you are. Here's money. Because I cannot do that. You know, there's a reason you shouldn't actually have all skills. Like it's not required of you to actually know how to do everything, especially in art. There is something to be said about, you know, a Renaissance person such that they know how to do a bunch of things. But realistically, I would say that each medium of art is a different way your brain processes. So a person who is a Renaissance person with art, I think probably has a lot of things firing, you know, and so being able to do that is sometimes a very calming element of all of the action going on there. But some of us are like, you know, I'm real good at this one thing. I'm going to keep doing that. I figure it's all right. That being said, your story about your teacher being so like rough to you with reference to your art piece, I could see why you would have a visceral reaction to it.
Looking back, she was clearly just concerned that I was just obviously kind of really upset about something.
I don't know, though. I mean, once you're working with kids, like, you can get a little jaded. And I've definitely seen teachers who, like, you know, they think the kids are doing something willful. And it's like, this is an 8-year-old. Like, the only thing willful he's doing is, like, not eating his peas at home. Like, it's he's not trying to do something to you. There's a lot of, like, adult things that we think kids are doing that, like, they're not even mentally, I mean, they just don't have the breadth of, I don't know, resentment and betrayal required to, like, do something just to get at the teacher. Like, it's like, I'm going to do my whole thing wrong just to spite you. Why? I don't know. I just don't think that that's, like, a real thing. And sometimes I think it's, like, adults being, putting their own, like, worldview on whatever. And realistically, like, she should have just supported you and been like, hey, bud, how's that going? This is not what I expected. So I wondered, would you love a tutor? There's this guy over here, great at drawing. He could help. And you guys could do a group project. What do you think?
You see, I think that this is something that kind of gets sort of missed when children don't kind of do kind of any sort of artistic expression or something like that at a young age. People just kind of go, oh, well, they're obviously just not very arty, or they're not into it. But like, when somebody is not good at maths or not good at English, or, you know, not good at, not able to pick up kind of languages or something like that, they go, oh, this person needs more help. They need to be maybe in a different kind of stream of class so that they can get more support. But the same thing doesn't happen really with art subjects. They don't go, well, why doesn't that child want to express themselves outwardly? They just kind of go, oh, well, they're obviously just shy and quiet. We'll just leave them to be shy and quiet, and they're not causing any trouble. So let's just move on to the ones that are being boisterously disobedient.
Yes, and crush their souls so that they can live as adults. Like, this one seems fine. She's quiet. She'll get through. I don't know. I mean, I don't think there is. I think you're right that there is not enough appreciation in education for the arts for various reasons, because, like, I feel like, okay, admittedly, my child's in pre-K, so there's a lot of art, you know. Yeah. But some art is really good for just understanding different kinds of stuff. And my kids grasped concepts that, like, I was surprised that he got from school. He'd come home with an art project and be like, see, this is how this works. And be like, oh, great. I'm so glad you understand that. Or, like, he makes a rocket ship and he's like, Mom, I want to go to space. And I was like, let's talk about space, you know. Awesome. Like, these kinds of things where it's like it gets the imagination going. But even to harken back to the idea that you're like, I'm not a creative kid, all I did was read books, I think that there is something to be said for the fact that we all process being a creative. All children are creative. You just sort of have to see the way that they are processing it, right? And, like, what way is cool with them? Like, for instance, speaking of art, my child not really into coloring that much. I see that they make him color quite a bit at school, so I don't try to bug him too much, because when I pull out those crayons, he's like, listen, I'm no thank you. You know, but, like, other different things, you know, I hand him some clay and he's like, oh, clay all day. Like, so just different kinds of things, vibe. And one is not right or wrong. In my mind, these kinds of things, and all art for further educational purposes, to hook into that part of the conversation, I think that they develop different kinds of skills in you that are not art related, right?
Yeah.
Like in the episode that came out today, actually, I was talking to Travius Lawson about the idea that at school they don't teach art appreciation, and how the idea of art appreciation could could actually help a person to make decisions about their life as they continue forward. Like you look at a piece of art and you decide whether how you feel about it. And then however you feel about it is right. Like there's no one, you know, that walks up to a painting and like has the class and is like, all right, guys, this painting right here was done by Rodin. He wanted you to be psyched when you looked at it. What do you guys think? Everybody happy? Awesome. Let's do it. Instead, they're like, this is where the guy was from. This is what was going on when he painted this. This is the material that he used to paint it. They just give you the bare facts, which are also interesting because you think about people. Then you think like, oh, this is a person who like, oh, used an actual brush or they're like, he used this thing. And you can imagine a person doing this thing. So if you can imagine the person and think about their life when they're creating this, that creates an empathy in you. But even if you can't connect to that alongside the art, you also have, this big red thing makes me feel this way. I have just taken in a piece of art and it has evoked an emotion in me. You did it. The idea of accepting your reaction to it, I think, is then later transferred when you are older and you are able to process something that happens to you in your life. You have an emotional reaction to it. And instead of just judging your emotional reaction, you're like, well, that must be how I feel, because you now trust that your feelings are valid. Right. Yeah. So in my mind, I think all art practices and all art appreciation are skills that bring you into real life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think because I had sort of such an aversion to drawing and stuff when I was a child, the first time that I really got kind of interested in art, in sort of like classical arts and things like that, was when I did religious studies. So I did it at A level and then I went on to university and did it there. And I got like really interested in kind of religious art across all different religions and through the ages. And, you know, all of the, you know, incredible similarities in these artworks that were from completely different cultures, celebrating different gods and different, you know, beings. But just these kind of explosions of emotion and all the kind of depth and complexity. Like my favorite artist is Caravaggio, because I love the darkness and the drama and all of it. And all of that has got, you know, they've got all of these sort of religious aspects to it. So I think, like you say, it's something that helps you to understand the world that in a much more kind of immediate way than learning about the, you know, the stories. Like the one of my favorite things is about Judith and Holofernes. That's the painting of Caravaggio's that I like the best, and it's a grim painting because it's of somebody that's just been decapitated, as you find in a lot of religious paintings. But it's so fraught with the like, with life and with death and with everything all at once. And reading the story, the Bible story about it, it's like, wow, that's a really impressive story. But when you see the painting, you're like, oh my God, that's insane. And it somehow brings it into real life, because you're like, oh yeah, that was a real person. I mean, obviously I don't know what people believe. I'm not religious myself, but whenever I'm kind of like, whenever I was reading those stories, I was thinking, well, even if this is just a story, it's a representation of real things that were happening and of real emotions. And when you see something as stark and dramatic as that, you can't help but kind of go, oh, I get it now. I understand what this is all about. And it's all of the passion, all of the strong emotions that are encapsulated within it. You get it so much more kind of viscerally sometimes through, you know, appreciating a painting. And I think too many people get put off, you know, appreciating different forms of art because they feel like they have to know everything. Now, you don't need to know anything about Caravaggio. You don't need to know anything about the story behind it to see that picture and go, oh, I know exactly what is happening in that picture because it's just hitting me in the face. or like with some other paintings where it's just like, oh, I don't really know what this is about, but I'm feeling a serene wave coming over me from this painting, or from this piece of music, or from this piece of performance art. I don't really know what they're doing, but it's evoking something in me. You don't need to know the ins and outs of everything to be able to appreciate it. And I think sometimes people can get too hung up on the details of it and intellectualize things to such an extent that it becomes a bit inaccessible for people.
Yeah. Sometimes I think that some people want art explained for them. And I think it's because the art that can be seen and it evokes emotion and it tells a story and it does, you know, sort of the work for you, those are so like rare and amazing and sort of like jewels in the dust. Like, you're, when you find that, it's like, oh wow, this is amazing. But realistically, I think it's individual. You know what I mean? Like, and the other thing is, like I said, like we were talking about with education, like if a teacher or somebody like makes it seem uncool to know these things or to feel these things or to have a reaction, like, then, you know, people are going to hold themselves back from it. Whatever it may, even if they do have feelings about it, they're not going to tell you about it. I mean, even to go back to, you know, you were reading your books, you said, I had a great fantasy life, but I wanted to keep it private. There's a lot of people that keep themselves closed forever. Like, they don't let anybody else into, you know, whatever's going on with that journey.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, you mentioned you did, you know, were in religious studies. How did that happen for you? Especially because you also mentioned that you weren't religious yourself.
Yeah.
I also am not particularly religious and did both high school and college at a Catholic school, which was heavily a lot of religious studies. So I get it because it was like, I look at it as a, sorry, this might be a little blasphemous, audience members, I apologize. But for me, it's like a really great story. And I think that it is a testament to how well it was written that it's a book that people continue to read. True or not, it's got to be a bit of a creative masterpiece because people keep going to it. Yeah. Like, they're opening that book over and over and over. And it's like, the guys that wrote that, they wrote something special, you know, that really just captured the audience so intensely. But why did you get into it?
Well, my school wasn't a Catholic school, wasn't religious school at all. And I've always been, I would say maybe on the agnostic side of atheist, like, I don't think there's a God, but I'm willing to be proved wrong. That's that's the kind of the way I look at it. It's like, I don't think there's anything else out there, but, you know, it would be very, I feel it would be very arrogant of me to say that I know for certain. But I think that's why I've always been kind of interested in, like, well, why do people have faith? Because I can't understand it. It's not something you can intellectually sort of understand. It's something you either feel or you don't. It's something you have or you don't have. I just became really interested in what is it that makes people religious, or what is it, how does that shape their life, how does that shape the way they make decisions? And there's so much vastness in the application of religion, even within a particular religion, even within a particular sort of denomination of a religion. There's still so much variance in the way that it's applied, and people seem to apply the same scripture in so many different ways. And so to me, I also was always really interested in English literature. And I was thinking, well, actually, these are kind of the same thing. They're both like, here's this central text. Here is how I understand it. And here is how it shaped the way that I think and the way that I behave. Because I think, you know, works of fiction and works of literature can equally do that to works of religion, in terms of, you know, I know that there are books that I have been shaped by and that have given me sort of curiosity about certain things or have helped me work out how I feel about certain things. And they're just as important to me as a religious text. So, yeah, I think I would, yeah, just became fascinated with, like, why religion? Why?
Yeah. Did you end up getting a degree or anything in that, or was it just a class?
So I've got a master's in religious studies.
Oh, you went all the way through. All right. Wow. Good.
Yeah. So, and I ended up, my final dissertation was on religion and film. And so the films that I studied for it were were really quite grim, depressing films. So I studied Breaking the Waves by Lars von Trier, which if you haven't seen it, quite a depressing movie. Bad Lieutenant by Abel Ferrara, again, quite a depressing movie. And Taxi Driver, again, fairly depressing movie. But I wrote about the idea of religious gift and grace within those films, because in each of those films, there's something about just completely giving yourself over to something else. Not necessarily in a positive way in all of those films, but yeah, so that's a central theme that I wrote about in those films.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. And quite an interest to buoy you all the way through a master's.
Yeah.
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 That's really fascinating that that's something that you are interested in. I think that that is awesome. I love the idea of examining that, and that your initial vibe was, you know, why, what keeps this fire burning for people. So you mentioned earlier that you started getting into performance arts when you turned 20. Was this as a respite from the heavy texts of you know, getting a master's in religious studies, or was it just like, you know, something offered on campus?
So it was actually after I finished my master's. I started working for the prison service, and again, just very, very strange sort of path in life. But just on the administrative side, I must stress that I was not a prison officer, because I think anybody that has seen the size of me would be like, huh, that doesn't really make sense. So I started working for the prison service, and I had this colleague who would come in every Tuesday morning, and she'd be so buoyed up. She'd be like, oh, improv was amazing last night, and we did this, and we did this, and we did this. And after a little while, at this point, I was still quite shy and quiet and retiring. And I sort of thought, oh, that sounds kind of interesting. I'm a bit intrigued. And so I said, oh, well, you know, where is the class? And she didn't want to tell me where the class was. And then because I've got a bit of a sort of a mischievous streak where because she didn't want to tell me where it was, I was like, if it's that good that she wants to keep it for herself, then I want to get in on this. So I found out where the class was, and I turned up, and yeah, that was the point at which something just clicked. So I came into this class, and the guy that was teaching it was a guy called David Ash, and he was in his, must have been in his sort of late 60s at that point. So I kind of came along, and I was sort of standing at the back and watching people, and he was like, you like, come up, you'll be in the next scene. And I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. I've never done this before. He's like, right, I'm going to give you a scenario. You're going to be a farmer in a field, and this person has been trespassing on your land, and you're going to tell them off. And I was just like, oh, okay. And I don't know what happened, but because I'm originally from Suffolk, which is quite a rural area, and I'd sort of dropped my accent when I went to university, because it's the Suffolk accent is quite a country bumpkin kind of accent. So when I got to university, and for the first time in my life, I was around all of these people that were from all parts of the country, I was like, I don't really want to sound like a country bumpkin anymore. So I'm just going to sort of smooth out my accent so it's just a bit more generic and nobody really knows where I'm from. But in when he said that you're a farmer, I was like, oh, I know how to do a farmer's voice because those of my family are farmers. So I just like snapped back into my Suffolk accent and he was just like, that was amazing. Where did that accent come from? I was like, from my family. It just kind of came out. I don't really know. Did I do it right? And he was like, that was brilliant. Do it again. You're going to be in the next scene. And then he and I became like really, really good friends, even though there was like a 40-odd year age gap between us. We had somehow had all the same references and, you know, knew all the same things and just got on like a house on fire. And it was, yeah, it was the first time in my life that I was like, oh, I can stand up and talk to people and not feel like my stomach is about to drop. And yeah, that was just amazing. And yeah, I've been doing improv ever since.
Wow, that's so great. So I'm intrigued because she wouldn't tell you. And then in the story, you didn't tell me. Where was the class?
It was in Lancaster, which is in the northwest of England. I have to, because whenever I see the Lancaster improv players, I always get a bit excited. And then I was like, oh no, they're not from my Lancaster. They're from the American Lancaster. So it was a place called the Deaf Centre. It was just like in a little community space. And there was a class of like a handful of people. But David was super passionate about improv, and every year he would go over to the US and, throughout all of my kind of formative improv education with David, I just heard about these amazing people. He kept talking about Jill Bernard and Joe Bill and all these people. And I was like, oh, they sound amazing. And now like I've actually met them and it's so bizarre.
It is wild. Did you get to meet them because of him? Like, did he get these personalities to come over and teach workshops? Or
I went with David to the Twin Cities Improv Festival like many years ago.
Wow.
And so I met all of the like loads of people at Huge Theatre, and Joe Bill was there to do some lead some workshops, and Christina Gausis, and yeah, just loads of amazing people were there. And so I was just like, oh, finally I get to meet all of these people that I've been hearing about for years and years.
Oh, that's so great. How amazing. I like that. It sounds like his, you know, support of you in that moment, you know, for the accent that was, you know, so perfectly placed for you that, you know, his confidence in you seems to have pulled you along and kept you with this crowd. Is this still the same theater that you are doing improv with now?
No, I moved away from Lancaster maybe nearly 10, no. So it's some years ago now. I can't keep track of the years.
I also don't know what year it is. It's fine.
I was at Improv Express, which was the name of the group in Lancaster, for many, many years. And then I took over teaching because David passed away. So I had to keep it going. So I then took on teaching. And again, that was another like, well, I suppose somebody's got to do this. So I guess it's me. So that was how I started teaching improv, because I think if it hadn't have been for that, I don't know whether I would have felt like I had the, you know, the requisite qualifications or knowledge to be able to teach it. But I was like, well, somebody has to keep this group going. And I really enjoy the sort of the teaching side of it. Like while he was still with us, David had let me kind of teach some sessions, and then he'd given me some very thorough notes about where I was going wrong. but he was really, really helpful as a mentor with that. And so he was always really encouraging, you know, if anybody in the group has a game that they want to play or an exercise that they want to do, go out, find some details about it, then you teach it to us. And so that's kind of an approach that I've kind of kept. So that's what I do with my group now, is say, if anybody's got an idea of what they want to do, they want, you know, we do a lot of short form. So I was like, if you've seen a YouTube video of a game you want to play, or you've read about a game, or you've seen it in another show, then let me know and I can help you iron out how it all works. But then you teach it to us, because I don't want to be the one teaching all the time. I want everybody to be empowered to teach, because I think it's such a great way of learning more about improv, is when you understand a game well enough to teach it to other people, you get to see like how it all kind of comes together, and you get more of an appreciation for, oh, okay, I need to explain this bit a bit more because people aren't getting it. Or, oh, actually, this doesn't really work for our group, so I need to tweak this a little bit in this way. So I just think it's such a good thing to get people involved in teaching and in sort of facilitating as early as possible, because it's something that I think loads of people can do. I think everybody can facilitate. But if you're not given the opportunity to do it, and if you're not given the support or somebody saying, yeah, come on, you can do this, I think most people would just be like, oh, no, I'm going to leave it to the professionals. And it's like, well, you know, we're all improvisers. We're all good at this. We can all do this. So you tell me how you want this game to be played.
I find, too, that for me, sometimes knowing how a game works will demystify the scariness of doing it, you know, like, and to your point, teaching it does give you a better framework of understanding how it works than even just reading about it or doing it yourself. Like, because when you watch, when you give the same prompt to, you know, 10 different people and they all come back with different things, you begin to notice the patterns in the responses. And then the patterns in the responses are then how it works for different people. And you can like tailor that to, hey, I noticed this group is a lot like this. I will tell them the instructions for this in this way, because that's how they're going to process it. Or like you said, getting somebody to explain something. When you explain like how a joke works, like sometimes we start, you know, my improv is mostly improv comedy. And the first thing people always say is, well, I want to do improv because people said it was cool, but I'm not funny. And I was like, cool, 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 cool. You don't actually need to be funny. I'll tell you what funny is. And then you guys can just do that. And it doesn't matter what you say, as long as there's a, you know, there's a rule of three and you're golden at that point. Like, you'll get into the rhythm later, but for now, just stick with that basic formula and you're going to be okay. And like giving them a roadmap that seems plausible really helps, you know? Like, three steps, guys. This is it. This is all you got to do. Three things have to happen. All right, we've established what's going to happen. We've heard it once. What's going to happen again? How are we going to make this? How are we going to heighten this scenario, right? And I feel like for me, I'm like super into structure. And so when I teach it, it helps me to see the structure a little bit better. And then I'm able to use that structure to teach it to them, you know? I really am. I think it's amazing that your mentor, David Ash, was so on point with training you to do some of the teaching. Sounds like his vibe was, you know, similar to what you're saying, which is everyone should have a chance to teach. Were there a lot of different people alongside you under David's wing, sort of learning how to teach? And was that kind of like a thing that he did for a bunch of different people, or
I mean, he was always really keen to kind of get everybody involved in it. And like when we did shows, he would sort of encourage some of the rest of us to maybe have a go at being the compere, or, you know, just to do like little different things. And I'm always really keen to get people doing that compere bit as well, because that's a different skill in itself, but it's such a useful one. And that, I think, I find the comparing bit kind of scarier than the improv bit, because the improv bit, you've got your structures, or you're not yourself in the improv bit. Whereas in the compare bit, you're just like, hi, I'm Jess, and I'm going to introduce you to this wonderful improv thing. And, you know, after this show, you're going to be amazed and amused and all of this sort of stuff. And like, that's really kind of so different from who I actually am. But if you can kind of encourage people to do that comparing aspect, it's just like, oh no, you just have to, you can be yourself, but just step into a slightly different version of yourself. Just put on your imaginary sparkly jacket and just go out there and do it, and it'll be fine.
Oh my God. I came out of the womb with my sparkly jacket on. So I definitely have a different view of going up in front. I'm always the first one to be like, yeah, I'll talk. What's that? Alone on stage, taking it. But yeah, when I teach a class, I often try to get the person who, even if they're the shyest, so when I'm teaching like a 101 class and there's a person, who in the class is sort of consistently bringing the group together, you know, there's usually one or two where like either they're the person who's like, hey guys, let's all go out for a drink after, or they're the one who joins me at the end of exercises to be like, that was so cool what you did. Like, oh my God, what a cool character. Cause like, you show me excessive positivity, improv teacher is your next step. Right. But first step is being the host of the little class show, because you will speak and the others in the class will feel like, he's speaking for us because he's our guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think exactly what you're saying about that enthusiasm. Like, I love it when I'm like teaching a class or leading like the Gloss of Improv, like our weekly kind of drop-in thing. And after a scene, I would just kind of say, so what do we think of that? And somebody's just like, oh yeah, I loved what they did with this and da da da. And then somebody else would be sort of quite sort of thoughtful and pensive. And they're like, I really liked the way that they took their time in that scene. And it made me realize that you don't always need to go in with a lot of dialogue. And I'm just sat there just going, my work is done. I don't need to do anything. I don't need to give any feedback, because it's so much better if it comes from the group, because it means more to you. Like when the people that you've just been improvising with, they're going, oh, you're brilliant, and you did this so well, and I couldn't even put my finger on what it was that you were doing until just now, and then I realized that you were doing this amazing thing and you've got this amazing skill. If people can get that from their peers rather than whoever is leading the class, it seems, firstly, it's like more sincere, because they think, well, these people have got no reason to try and kind of pump me up or make me feel better, whereas the teacher has a reason to do that, because they're wanting to encourage me, or, you know, they're wanting me to come along to the next class or whatever it is.
Which, no, you know, you're
in
right.
Some cases, you get the feedback from your teacher and you're just like, yeah, I know I didn't do very well in that scene, so please don't tell me that I was brilliant.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You just say, some people, you just say, oh, thank you for the compliment, but I'm not so keen on what I just did. But when you hear it from other people, you just say, oh yeah, actually they all think it was good. So maybe it wasn't the absolute flaming car wreck that I thought it was.
Yeah. You know, I feel like this was in a thread online about improv and, you know, sort of notes that one had received from their fellow troupe mates. And I would say that, you know, as the leader, whether as being a coach or as the teacher of a class, I'm often like, I am happy for you guys to give notes to one another, but I only want to hear positive notes. Like, what did you like about the scene? What did this person execute well? You know, I will give notes. Don't worry. Don't worry, you guys. I will give plenty of notes that are like, no, don't do that. So you guys, your job to balance me out is that you guys will say positive things, because let's be honest, guys, I need some balancing, right? The other thing is, you mentioned earlier that you were from Suffolk, so you like softened your accent. I am from Boston, Massachusetts, which is known to have a pretty rough accent. And
it's my favorite accent in the world.
I'm so glad. I did not love it. Because I grew up in it and I wanted to be a person on stage. And mm-hmm. I was like, I can't have this accent. That's unacceptable. So I too softened it so that people can't tell. However, the innate Boston-ness of me, i.e., I'll tell you what you did wrong, that is always there. That is always in there. So I usually tell my class, like, hi, guys, how you doing? I know we're here in Austin and it's a magical wonderland, but I'm from Boston, so the barbs are out, okay? So contrast to me, you guys need to be real nice to each other, and I'll tell you why. So, I mean, that and then it turns out I'm nice and they're like, I see what she did there. She made me expect her to be mean. And then I'm really like, you guys are really amazing. And they're like, she's crying. Is she angry crying? I'm really into this idea of, you know, working to support one another. I think that's one of my favorite parts about improv. Mm-hmm. When I didn't find improv as an art form until I was 30, and I had hit a lot of different art scenes previous to that. And the one that kind of resonated the same, sort of rang the same bell was I did this open mic in New York City. I lived in New York City for about 5 years in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And I went to this open mic, and it was called Reverend Jen's Anti-Slam. And poetry slams, apparently, in the area were known to be particularly rough when giving, when the judges told you, did your performance and everyone's like, oh my God, that's so great. And then the judges are like, let me tell you why it's a bad. And they give you pretty low scores, right? So she was tired of the poetry slam scene, and she wanted to create a space where you could go up on stage, do whatever you want, and at the end we all give you a 10. So at the end of every single set, you know, so and so would finish on the stage and she'd be like, everybody keep it going for Joe. And then they're like, all right, judges, and then everyone goes 10. And this idea that no matter what they did, it got a 10, and the idea that we supported each other through our artistic experiences, even if we were like, this isn't something I would do at all. I mean, there were some performance art pieces where I was like horrified, but I was like, well, this is how they're expressing themselves. Who am I to judge, right? And that vibe permeated that whole scene. And then when I got to improv, I was like, oh, these things come together. Like, this full support of each other. This, like, you're a 10 no matter what, baby. Like, no mistakes. Like, I got your back. The vibe of that really, like, connected.
Yeah, I think I was very lucky to start doing improv in Lancaster, which is it's a university city. It's quite a small city. It's more like a big town, and, like, everybody knows each other. And the art scene there is just very lovely, very hippie. And so the open mics there, you would just get like a mix of kind of some nice singer-songwriters and poets, and occasionally a weird performance art thing, like a woman that was completely naked apart from a horse head mask. Mm-hmm. And you just get kind of this a very weird kind of mix of things. So improv just fit right into that. Because it was just like, oh, yeah, we're just going to come and do some scenes for you. Give us some suggestions. And then people just like, yay, they used my suggestion. Woo, this is the best thing ever. So it was a really nice kind of way to get into improv. And it was, such an easy audience. Whereas kind of I was sort of part of a comedy sports thing for a little while. I wasn't in the main team. I was in another team. And that was just not really my scene because of the competitive nature and the super fast nature of it. Like, my brain, like, doesn't go that fast. And also it doesn't really want to go that fast because I want to veer off and see this character and the weird little cottage that she lives in, or, you know, whatever it is. And so I find it a bit too much for me. So that wasn't my sort of thing. So then sort of wherever I go, I sort of tend to, you know, start a new thing. So then when I moved to Glossop out of Manchester — Glossop is a very small town in Derbyshire — I was like, right, I'm not just going to set up an improv thing as soon as I get here. No, I'm just going to I'm going to sort of bed myself in for a little while. I'm going to get to know some people and I'm just going to have a lovely time doing some amateur dramatics at the local theatre. That's how I'm going to get to know people. So that's what I did. Got involved literally the day after we moved to Glossop. I just turned up at the theatre. I was like, hello, I'm Jess. I'm here to help out. Would you like me to help with props or prompting you or anything else? I'll just help out. I'll sweep the stage if that's what you need. So then I sort of got embedded in the, you know, the amateur dramatics group here. And then I met Seki and found that she was also really into improv. And then after a while, I was like, we were both like, oh, it would be great if we could have an improv group here. And I was like, oh, okay, let's make it happen then. So we did. And I was like, it was not my intention to come to Glossop and start an improv group, but that's what I ended up doing.
Why were you resisting?
Because I don't know. I don't want things to be about me. So I'm not very much of a, like, I'm come along to my amazing improv group because I'm an amazing improviser. I was just like, oh, this little community needs an improv group, doesn't it? I just realized, I was like, oh, it's an improv group that's missing.
It's funny. As I mentioned earlier about my reticence to believe that anyone listens to the podcast for me, like, it's hard to acknowledge the idea that, you know, to do the, hey, everybody, I'm amazing. So you want to spend some time with me? I've got hours of it you can do. Like that idea or like, I've got something to teach you. Look at me. I'm an authority. It's really tough to, you know, convince yourself to do it, but
it's that imposter syndrome. It's so strong that.
But I would say you really have to do it because if you even have the inclination, know that like 90% of everyone else around you does not have the inclination. Like, not only do they not have the skills you happen to have, but also like they don't want to deal with the organizational aspect of doing something like this. So if like you want to do it like me, oh my God, you want a long running show that goes on forever and has a lot of paperwork, I'm your gal. Why? Yeah. I don't know why. I'm obsessed with that stuff. Like organizing and getting people to go places and like sending emails. Loving it.
Yeah. Why?
But no one wants to do it. So if I want to, I feel like it's my duty to do it because there's so many people that are like, I do not need to be involved in this, you know, but it needs to happen.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, is trying to communicate to people that the reason that I am in charge of this thing is not in any way because I want to be the face of a thing or I want to be in charge of a thing. It's just that I'm really good at admin and I'm really good at organization. And I'm really good at when people say, oh yeah, we should do a thing sometime. I have already set up the doodle poll that is going to work out the dates of when we can all get together to do that. I'm already messaging you to get your bio so that we can put some promotional material together.
Nice.
Yeah.
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 I mean, but it's a skill so many few people have. Be excited that this is your skill. Like the world needs us where they're like, you would like to organize what? And you're like, yeah. I mean, what is that? 600 people you need to all meet in one location from all across the world? Got it. It's fine. Like ridiculous, right? I love that stuff. Oh, man, I got myself duped into tons of projects like that throughout my life.
Yeah.
I'm like, sure.
Yeah, I work in a university and I'm currently a fellow of the Association of University Administrators. So I've got a fellowship in administration. It's so ridiculous.
I love it.
I just can't get enough of organizing things that not only do I do it during working hours, I also do it pretty much all my spare time as well. I think this is the thing, though, that that I think people maybe don't see, and like me, kind of go, well, I'm not a creative person because I'm not, you know, outwardly expressive about things, and I can't draw and I can't sing and I can't dance and all that sort of thing. But there's so much other stuff that's involved in making a creative project happen that even if you've got absolutely no interest in being up on stage, you still can get really involved in really important and interesting creative stuff. Like, I'm in awe of people that can do all of the tech stuff for shows, because I'm no good with technology, really. But it's such a skill, and it's such a brilliant skill, and it's such a creative skill. You know, there's all these brilliant people like Charlotte Brienne Brown that do all of this stuff that I'm just like, this is just witchcraft. I don't know how you're doing all of this and making this all look so pretty in the moment as shows are going on. And it's just, it's such a creative thing. And I don't think that gets kind of talked about enough, all of the editing and mixing and all of that kind of stuff. So,
oh yeah, there's so many skills that people just do not associate with this. And you're right. We've been excitedly talking about admin because that's our jam, but like, you're right though. That kind of stuff is super important. If you're like, I'd love to be around theater people, but I do not want to go on stage. There are so many other things that you can get involved in, and we need help because nobody wants to do things. And like, the people who want to be on stage who are great are often not the people who are signing up to help in the various projects required to do, you know, a theater. I ran a theater for a while, and you know, you'd be surprised how often you're cleaning toilets and buying toilet paper. Yeah. Like, it's, you're like, okay, I guess I mop now every day. That's a thing that is my life, right? It's just like, different things that you don't think about. Man, when I found a person to take over that mopping for me, whoo, they were my best friend. Did I call them every time something cool came up? Yes. Yes, I did. What's that? You have some extra tickets to go see Dave Chappelle? Hey, after you mop, you want to go see Dave Chappelle? Got it. Free tickets for you. You know what I mean? Like, you help the people that run the theater. They get stuff. They give it to you. Like, that's cool. And also, maybe you have a special skill that, gosh darn it, we really need. You know, maybe you make costumes at home and you're like, gosh, I wish I could dress a person. I've got a few people you could dress. If you're like really good with technology, it's like, turns out half of our classes are online. Could you help us maintain that server? Like, great. You know, get up in there. Are you good with carpentry? Because this thing just broke. We'd love your help. Absolutely. Like, all sorts of things like that, where like, you don't think this is related to theater, but every single skill that is out there could benefit, right? And then to flip it back to a beginning of our conversation with arts education, being part of a theater and being part of a group creating a project together, individual parts, even just the witnessing of all these things coming together and how sort of managerially that works, teaches you to run it your own way. Oh, I like the way they do it. Oh, I don't like the way that they do it. So now you have a way you like to do things, right? You can manage because you've been in this space before. You understand how to interact with humans. That's a tough skill, right?
And
not even on stage. It's like in a meeting where it's like, okay, guys, listen, we're going to talk about October and how we're going to get it all done. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, every person who is interested in being part of a theater, whether they want to be on stage or not, should totally go hang out with them. They want to do it, right? They want it to be a group experience. Like you were talking about, you're like, I'm just trying to create a space for people to perform. I'm into that. I like that. I think that's probably better from a leader standpoint. I think that a lot of improv across the earth has been hurt by people who go into theaters with this God complex of like, I don't know if you know how much I know, but I'm going to share it with you one class at a time. And you're like, cool. Thank you. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing to try to get involved in this kind of stuff. How are you making it work right now? Like, what's the flow? Are you guys in person yet? How's the adjustment been?
Yeah, we're about to start back up again online because we've just had a summer break just over the past kind of month or so. Mainly because Seki and I have both had a load of life stuff going on. So we're like, we could probably do with just having a little break. And, you know, probably everybody else could too. So we've been online throughout the pandemic. And we're looking at starting again in a couple of weeks' time. And because over the pandemic, we've had people join us from sort of around the country and sort of from a couple of other countries as well, we sort of thought it doesn't really make sense to just go, all right, shut that down now, and we'll go back to just meeting every week in Glossop. Because now quite a few of the people that are in our group and really important members of our group are not in Glossop. They're in Liverpool or Lancaster or a few other places. And so we sort of decided that what we're going to do is a kind of a Glossop Improv on tour, where we have, you know, a workshop that's a bit of a longer workshop, and maybe get a guest teacher in, and then have people come to Glossop for that. And then we'll do one in Lancaster, or then we'll do one in Liverpool, and try and kind of move it around a bit so that we can actually get to meet in person some of these wonderful people that we've been improvising with over the past year and a half. But we did have one in-person session. David Escobedo very kindly came to teach us, and it was brilliant. He's so, so clever at knowing exactly what a group needs. He's so intuitive about reading in a split second all of the dynamics between a group and really shaping the session to be exactly what that group needs. So he did a lot of stuff that was very physical but still quite distant, and it was very, very clever the way he did it, because it wasn't like you're all going to stay 2 meters apart for the duration of this. It was just you're all going to walk across the room at the same time, but by the nature of it, we would be stood, you know, a fair distance apart, because we're all traveling in the same direction. So we're like in lanes, like swimming lanes, or, you know, lanes on a running track or something. And then there were some other kind of mime things where, oh, you're going to move this fridge. So it had four people all at the different corners of a refrigerator. So again, distance, but without saying you need to make sure that you don't touch anybody, you need to make sure that you stay separate from each other, just in a very organic way, got us back into our bodies, back into movement, back into sort of judging, picking up on people's body language and tones of voice in things, and really stripping back a load of noise, so that everything was very kind of focused and really about connections with one another. And So that was amazing. So I'm hoping to get Becky Webb to come and do a clowning and physicality session for us sometime soon, because again, I want to kind of ease people back into it until everybody feels comfortable being close together. I want to kind of err on the side of caution and err on the side of making sure that nobody feels like they're missing out by not wanting to be in sort of fairly close contact with one another.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very kind of you. And I think very innovative of David to come up with exercises that handled, you know, the issues without directly talking about the issues. Yeah. I think there's a lot to be said in coping with what we've all gone through that involves some talking about it and some not talking about it, you know?
Yeah. It's like I've gone to some sessions online during the pandemic when the facilitator or the teacher has sort of done the check-in at the start and sort of said, are there any topics that people don't want to talk about? And people have been like, please, no COVID talk, nothing to do with COVID. But then there's been others where kind of people have said, like, actually, you know, there's a load of stuff going on, but I don't mind talking about COVID because that's what's going on right now. So we're okay with it. But yeah, I think you've got to try and get a sense of where everybody is and try and find some kind of middle ground where it's like, well, we're not going to ignore that this is unusual and, you know, less than ideal maybe in the way that we might want to interact, but we're also going to see it as an opportunity to, okay, let's interact in other ways, or let's find an interesting way of justifying, because that's what we do as improvisers. We make a choice and then we justify it. So if the choice is, we're going to do this whole scene 2 meters apart, why are these people 2 meters apart? Like, there is a world of possibilities why these people might be 2 meters apart. They might be carrying a wardrobe between them. They might be, you know, bitter rivals that are just, you know, facing up in front of a, at the start of a contest or something.
Yeah.
There's all these things where the situation that we've been sort of thrown into is, you know, an offer. So, you know, take it as an offer.
Mm. Man, that's an interesting way of thinking of it, for sure. For sure. That's fascinating. So I want to ask you one final question. Thank you so much for giving me time in your day. I wanted to ask you, what is it for you that is creatively filling up your cup? Like, what is it that's making you, you know, that's keeping the fires burning for you creatively? And maybe it's reading a book, or, you know, watching a movie or something like that, or knitting a sweater. It doesn't have to be theatrical. If it is, great. But, like, what do you think right now is making you, you know, excited to be creative?
At the moment, I'm, because I've just had a little break from improv and I've got to catch up with family, some of whom I haven't seen since January 2020. And, you know, getting to have that contact with family again is just kind of, yeah, reinvigorated my sort of sense of how important it is to have that connection and to really, I find myself really kind of studying my family members when I was there, because I've spent the whole of like the last year and a half, I've really kind of thrown myself into taking as many workshops and courses and things as I can, because actually I think that's my favorite aspect of improv. Like, I like learning it is probably at the top, teaching it is probably second, and then performing it is third for me, which I know is probably flipped from how a lot of people are, but that's just what I like. So when I kind of saw my family, I was like, oh, listening for the, you know, the cadences in their voices and the way that they use language and the way that they interact with each other. And I think being on Zoom, being so focused on people and expressions and tones of voice and things like that, has given me such more of a appreciation for the richness in communication and different kind of body languages. And I think it's made me sort of a bit more perceptive about, like, oh, did you just see the way that person looked at that person? And all of that, where normally I would be kind of oblivious to it in a kind of a social setting because there's loads of stuff going on. But now I'm kind of just like honing in on people's faces. So I think that kind of, yeah, really sort of looking and really listening to people is what is I'm finding really fascinating at the moment. I recently went to an accent workshop with Chloe English that Kate Bell set up as part of All Made Up Improv. And it was a general American accent session. And it got really down to like fine detail about where to place your tongue in your mouth when you do the American R sound, which is very different from the most of the UK R sounds. And I was like, oh, this is just the best, because this is like really nerdy, really particular kind of, this isn't even improv, this is linguistics and, you know, phonics and things. So finding those like fine details and kind of storing them away for future use in improv or just in communication, I think is what is sort of feeding my soul at the moment.
Oh, that's so awesome. I love this idea that improv and workshops that you've done online have opened your eyes to sort of a new way of observing the world around you. Mm. That's so, Oh, that's so exciting. I really feel like I'm a big proponent of improv can save the world. And I feel like, you know, improv teachers are like the armchair therapists required right now to, you know, sort of ease some of the sadness and the weight that, you know, the pandemic has held, and that all of the international workshops are just like training us all to, you know, be a little bit more focused and better in the world, because everyone's kind of on edge and at the end of their rope. And we keep being like, hold on just one second. I just invented some more rope. I got some more rope right here. Like, and they're like, not improvised rope. And I was like, you weren't specific. I have it. Yeah. Like, so the idea of this new perception of, you know, observation, I think that is amazing. And what a cool way to, like, appreciate your family and, like, get them on such an adult level. That's an interesting part about interacting with your family as an adult.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think because I live quite far away from them, so whenever I see them, it's, like, it's quite a rare event. So you just, like... And like seeing kind of my younger relatives grow up, and it's just so fascinating where, like, you know, somebody who last time I saw them was like 11 or 12, and now they're like, I'm proper grown up now because I'm 14. And just had a very adult conversation with me about her new point shoes that she's got for ballet, and was telling me all about, these are different from the Russian style because they've got a wood block at the back. And I was just like, I don't remember asking for this, but by all means, tell me all of the details about point shoes. I'm now fascinated and I want to know everything.
Yeah, I'm excited because you're excited. Tell me what you're excited about.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's like enthusiasm is the most attractive quality, and it doesn't matter what it's about. It's just, if somebody is passionate about something, it's just like, yeah, tell me more about the best way to clean a drain, because now I feel like I really need to know. Or, you know, whatever it is that somebody has knowledge of.
Yeah.
Like, just talk about it at length. And too often people kind of go, oh, but this is really boring, or, oh, you don't really want to know about this, or, oh, I nerded out there a bit. It's like, yeah, carry on, keep going, keep nerding out, because if you're excited about this, I want to know everything about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love positivity and being enthusiastic about stuff, but, you know, it's like there's a clap back from sort of the loud negative majority or minority, really, but they're loud. And they, you know, whether it's the voice in your head that's all like, that's a bad idea. Like you said, when the people are like, you don't want to know, you don't want to know. It's like, that's the voice in their head being like, nobody cares about this but you. Mm-hmm. And then there's people on the internet or in your life who are like, why do you care about this? This is dumb. And that's real. And so if you can buoy yourself enough to have enthusiasm for life, for other people's life, it's like an admin skill. Absolutely necessary. Yeah. Absolutely necessary.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my God. Jess, thank you so much for being on the podcast. This has been a total pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.